need or want an answer to that question. Julian got out and Grimshaw continued up to the house. When he saw the young officer standing with his back to the house's front door, he put the car in park, touched the metal under his shirt, and whispered his prayer to Mikos. Then he stepped out of the car, using the door as a shield while he looked around. Man on the ground, within sight of the house, not moving. The baby cop didn't look injured. At least he wasn't bleeding anywhere, but could be in shock. Grimshaw stepped away from the car, closed the door, and approached the survivor.
Officer?
Osgood, sir. David Osgood.
You hurt?
No, sir. I was just...
Grimshaw held up a hand.
We'll get to that. Anyone else around?
An abrupt, hysterical laugh quickly cut off.
Caw! 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 Caw!
One question answered, but not in the way he wanted.
Stay there.
Not that he expected the kid to move while he approached the man on the ground. He didn't know when he stopped moving. He just gradually realized his feet had frozen in place once his brain understood what he was seeing. The CIU officer lay face down. Grimshaw clearly saw the back of the man's sports jacket and the back of his head. He also saw the shoes that were pointing up. Spinal injury. Gods above and below. After that moment of shock, he approached the man to check for a pulse and hoped he wouldn't find one. Satisfied that he wasn't leaving an injured man, he returned to Osgood and led the young officer to his vehicle. Once inside the car with the doors locked, as if a locked door would provide any kind of safety, he called Captain Hargreaves to let him know backup wasn't required, but another CIU team would be needed to investigate the reason for the attack, or at least to take possession of the damaged vehicle. He finished the call to Hargreaves and turned in his seat to look at Osgood.
Can you tell me what happened?
They would need to take a formal statement, and maybe he shouldn't be the one asking questions now. But Swin wasn't here, and he didn't want anyone trying to convince Osgood to change his story.
Detective Swin and Detective Reynolds took Miss Devine to Sproing to answer some questions, Osgood said. But not before Miss Devine made it real clear that we weren't allowed to snoop around inside her house or car or the cabins. And some of them heard her say it.
Snoop. An interesting word for a cop to use. What it said to him was the baby cop had felt uneasy about Swin's orders.
There was a girl with Miss Devine, a girl with black hair, Osgood continued. I think she was one of them.
She's one of the Crow Guard.
He studied Osgood.
They're called Terra Indigene, or Earth Natives, or others. Talking about us and them is part of what caused the trouble and got a lot of people killed in the past year.
Yes, sir.
Osgood said nothing for a minute.
Once Detective Swin left, Detective Calhoun told me to stay out front while he and Detective Chesnick took a look around back. I was checking out the wooden chair near the front door. Nice chair. I was thinking my grandma would like one like that when there was a scream from around back. Baker told me to stay put and ran around to the back of the house. The three of them returned in a minute. Calhoun and Baker had Chesnick between them. There was a necktie tied around Chesnick's leg, and his pants leg was soaked with blood. They yelled something about him being attacked and needing to get him to a hospital. So they put Chesnick in the back seat, and Calhoun started driving down the gravel road.
What was Chesnick doing when he was attacked?
I didn't see anything. I was out front.
Good guess that the next CIU team to come calling would find someone had tampered with the lock, but didn't manage to get in.
I heard the car crash into something, Osgood said. I thought maybe Calhoun had been driving too fast on the gravel and hit a tree or something, and I started down the road to see if I could help. But Baker must have heard something in the trees over there, because he headed away from the house and drew his service weapon and I wasn't sure if I should stay and help him or go and help Calhoun. And then...
What did you see?
Grimshaw asked when Osgood stopped talking.
Officer, what did you see?
I didn't see anything. A note of hysteria. One moment, Baker was running away from the house and had his weapon drawn, and the next...
Osgood swallowed convulsively.
Something grabbed him and twisted him like it was squeezing water out of a wet rag.
Osgood scrabbled at the door.
Grimshaw released the locks in time for the young man to bolt out of the car and stagger a few steps before he bent over and puked. Grimshaw's mobile phone rang. Keeping an eye on Osgood, he answered.
Grimshaw, the driver is still alive but has severe head and neck injuries,
Julian said.
I don't think he'll make it, but the EMTs are here. So is the Sproing Volunteer Fire Department. They said someone called them and the EMTs and told them to get over to the jumble. My guess is it was one of the Sanguinati who were at the bank. The volunteers and EMTs are working to get the driver out of the car so the ambulance can take him to Bristol Hospital.
The driver. That would be Calhoun.
Long drive for a seriously injured man. Nothing closer. One of Sproing's doctors is also here. He'll do what he can to help the EMTs stabilize the patient, but he says the man needs more help than he and his office can provide. And the other detective?
When Julian didn't answer, Grimshaw's voice sharpened.
Julian? Something shredded his legs. Elders? Not for me to say.
Yeah. Especially out in the open, where you didn't know who or what was listening.
What about you?
Julian asked.
You find the baby cop? He's puking his guts out at the moment, but doesn't appear to be physically injured. The other man, Detective Baker.
What about him?
He's dead. Spinal injury.
He heard Julian suck in a breath.
I'll walk up and meet you.
He wanted to tell Julian to stay put, but he realized if Julian Farrow felt all right about coming farther into the jumble's land, they weren't at risk. Until someone did something stupid. Chapter 11. Vicky. Sunday, June 13th. I went to the slatted screen door that opened out on a multi-level deck that overlooked the lake. There was a variety of very nice, and very expensive, since it was handcrafted, outdoor furniture that I wished I could afford for my screened-in porch. Then again, Aggie thought my second-hand stuff was pretty fancy, so I guess it was a case of eye of the beholder.
Are you sure I shouldn't be there? I asked, looking over my shoulder at Ilya Sanguinati. Those sirens sounded like they were at the jumble.
The jumble was my responsibility, at least until I lost control of it, so I should be aware of what was happening. On the other hand, if I wasn't there, I couldn't be blamed for whatever had happened, right?
I'm sure you shouldn't be there, he replied.
The police caused a problem, and they'll have it fixed before I escort you home.
He seemed real certain of that. I was almost as certain about something else. Someone died, I said. He looked up from the papers he had spread over a square coffee table that was bigger than my kitchen table.
Yes.
It wasn't the young officer, was it? In the thrillers I read, the young, less experienced officer was always the first one killed, so the rest of the men would realize there was danger lurking nearby.
No, it wasn't the young one.
And Officer Grimshaw is all right?
He studied me. Is that important to you?
There was nothing in Ilya Sanguinati's voice to indicate anything but mild curiosity, but I had a feeling Grimshaw's future depended on my answer.
He was kind, I replied. And he's a police officer you can depend on when you need help.
Unlike Detective Oilslick, I added silently. I had revised my opinion of Officer Grimshaw during our second encounter,
when his presence had helped me deal with Detective Swin and the discovery of the theft of the items in my safe deposit box. When he came to the jumble, I was plenty nervous about leading him to a dead body, but he might have been nervous too, and sounded a bit testy because of it. After all, cops really didn't like coming to Sproing because at least two of them had ended up inconveniently dead after responding to calls around here. At least, that's what I remember from the carefully edited news reports that were on TV a while ago. And now, if I understood what Ilya meant about a problem the police had to fix before I went home, they had at least one more reason to avoid the village whenever possible. I returned to one of the chairs around the coffee table, determined to understand the papers the dead man had carried with him. But I kept looking at the items neatly lined up near the table. A knapsack and a thermos, a silver pen and pencil set, a silver business card holder, and a money clip, sans money. I didn't know which kind of Terra Indigene would be interested in the knapsack and thermos, but I could guess who had taken possession of all the shiny items, and how much having to give them to Ilya had ruffled the Crow Guard's feathers. "Shouldn't those go to the police?" I asked. "Why?" Ilya Sanguinati looked amused. "I believe the human phrase is finders keepers." After a moment, he added, "The Sanguinati didn't take those items, but I did require that they be brought here in case there was anything of import inside them." "Like the papers?" I almost pointed out that the police would like to have all this stuff for evidence, but being an attorney, Ilya already knew that, and he didn't care because, right now, helping the police investigate the first dead man meant helping Detective Swin, and my yummy vampire attorney wasn't going to do that. "Like the papers," Ilya agreed. I looked through the papers again. After a few minutes, I shook my head. "This is wrong. This is all wrong."
"What exactly is wrong?"
I heard no condescension in the question, so I pulled out the first papers, which were an artist's rendering of cottages and the social center for a luxury resort. All of these papers are plans for a luxury resort. Very exclusive, since there would be 24 row cottages, as well as the social center, which would provide fine dining and an activities room, library, card room, etc. Within the grounds, the rendering shows tennis courts, as well as two docks, and look! I jabbed at the rendering. Motorboats! Who was the bozo who put this proposal together without looking at any of the conditions and restrictions? Because this... And the last piece of paper was the one that tipped me over into pissed off and fighting mad, which was quite an invigorating feeling, as long as I didn't have to fight with anyone who was bigger, stronger, or meaner than me, which was just about everyone. Unfortunately, the only person to fight with was a vampire, who was my attorney, whom I couldn't afford in the first place, so I probably didn't want to alienate him to the point of not helping me. "This is the jumble," I said with more control. "Okay." I was gritting my teeth and kind of scratching at the paper, but I wasn't going all wild woman, except for my hair. But that was its usual state. "When I took possession of the property, I studied the map that came with all the original documents that dictated what the person who owned the buildings could and couldn't do. So I know this is a map of the jumble showing where all these luxury cottages would be located, where the tennis courts would go, and a parking lot for crying out loud, none of which are permissible under the land use terms of the original agreement." I'd fretted over where to put cars if I actually had more than six lodgers. There were places near the cabins where you could park, but you reached those areas by driving on what amounted to an open track in the woods, single lane, unpaved. The grass between the tire tracks looked mowed, more or less. Grazed might be a better description. Maybe that's why the old records that I'd been given had mentioned goats, nature's lawnmowers.
"What were the terms of the original agreement?"
Ilya Sanguinati asked. "If I could just get my papers, I could show you how this resort goes against the agreement."
"We don't need your documents," I already have the second set of originals. I blinked.
You do?
I imagined giving myself a head slap.
You wrote up the original agreement.
Not me personally. That was a bit before my time.
He looked to be in his mid to late 30s, so either the Sanguinati aged differently than humans, which was likely with them being others and all that, or he was lacing the words with dry humor when he said a few human generations was a bit before his time.
A couple of residents from Silence Lodge did create the original contract, and we've enforced the terms of that agreement ever since. But I never saw you until now. No one came to check on the work to make sure it complied with the agreement. He smiled, and I realized how naive I sounded. Of course they'd checked on the work. We thought knowing about our presence might distress you, so we kept our distance. Now? He did one of those subtle shrug movements with his shoulders. Someone was interfering with you, so it was time to step in. Please tell me your understanding of the original documents. I took a breath. The anger had burned off, leaving me a little shaky. Well, the gist was that the person who owned the jumble couldn't add more buildings and couldn't add on to existing structures to increase the overall square footage of any of the buildings, but could renovate and update the buildings to be in keeping with the times and local customs. Only so many acres could be cleared for crops that would be used as a food source for the residents or to trade for other items. Trees could be cut for firewood, or if they became a hazard to a structure due to death or disease. Any other changes could be made only with the consent of the land managers. Since there wasn't any contact information for these land managers, I was very careful about updating only what I needed to in order for the buildings to be sound and have the amenities paying guests would want, like ensuite bathrooms, electricity, a roof that didn't leak, and plumbing that did what plumbing is supposed to do. I finally took the next step. Whoever that man worked for wanted to turn the jumble into a posh lakeside resort, which would mean buying me out, or forcing me out. I looked at Ilya Sanguinati. Would someone really kill a man and try to implicate me in his death in order to get access to the jumble? There has to be other land where someone could build a resort. He took his time before answering. There isn't any human-controlled land in the Feather Lakes area, so there isn't any place where a new resort could be built. Investors would have to buy the buildings and the land lease for an existing place, and there are a few places similar to the jumble throughout the northeast region where humans can take a lakeside vacation or fish in the streams without having to totally rough it, as I think you call it. But those places would have the same kinds of restrictions as the jumble, and none of that land is owned in the same way as the jumble, making it even more dangerous for someone to come in and try to interfere with what already exists. And that doesn't take into account the difficulty of acquiring building materials, something the human who drew up those plans clearly hadn't considered. Huh. Hadn't thought about that. After I had arrived in Sproing and made a list of what I knew would have to be updated in the main house and the three lakeside cabins, I'd contacted companies in Bristol and Crystalton, the two towns of any size that were within range of Sproing. I'd ended up going with the companies in Crystalton, companies both Inica and Julian Farrow had recommended. Well, Julian had recommended companies in Crystalton in general. It was Inica who gave me specific names of contractors in Crystalton who could do the big renovations, as well as the names of reliable people in Sproing who could fix a leaky faucet or paint the rooms for a fair price. The Crystalton contractors said there was a waiting list for building supplies because there were further limits on raw materials after the war humans had foolishly waged against the Terra Indigene last summer. Then the men had winked and said they would put in a good word for me. I don't know who they talked to or what they said, but the supplies came in and the work was done. Are the Sanguinati the land managers for the jumble?
I asked, wondering how much financial interest the residents of Silence Lodge had in the land on the other side of the lake.
No,
Ilya replied.
Then who is?
A hesitation.
The rest of the Terra Indigene call them the Elders.
You mentioned the Elders when Officer Grimshaw called about the new trouble. Who are they?
They are Namid's teeth and claws.
Oh, crap. So they're what? The world's hitmen? He blinked. Then he laughed. A rich, deep sound. Personally, I didn't think the question was that funny, especially when I started wondering how the dead man ended up dead.
That is one way of putting it, Ilya finally said as he wiped his eyes.
Since he found that amusing, I really didn't want to know what other ways you could put it. If the elders are the land managers, I'm guessing they aren't going to rub their paws together in greedy glee over the prospect of having the woodland overrun with humans.
I suddenly remembered a couple of bad jokes that were going around last summer, just before Yorick started divorce proceedings, and told me to find an apartment because he was keeping the upscale home in Hubney that, apparently, the second official Mrs. York Dane coveted.
Joke 1. Why did the bear chase the track team? He wanted some fast food.
Joke 2. What do you call a flock of chickens caught in a fire tornado?
Shake and bake.
On second thought, maybe the elders would be happy about easy meals on their land, like campers who talk about tossing a line in the water and catching a couple of fish for dinner.
12 cabins updated to match the times and social customs, Ilya said, sounding serious now. No more, and nothing more.
I pushed my fingers through my hair, and wondered just how badly I'd been played.
What was that man doing here? I certainly wasn't going to try to build a resort on this land.
Clearly someone thought it could be finagled.
Who?
I could see my ex-husband showing up now that I've had a few months to realize how hard I'm going to have to work for so little return.
Little return in human terms, perhaps. But there are other ways to measure a rich life,
Ilya countered.
I tipped my head to indicate agreement.
But going with the reasoning in human terms, I could see him offering the cash equivalent of the jumble as it had been valued at the time of the divorce settlement, completely ignoring all the money I'd put in for capital improvements. I could see him doing that, but he wasn't the person who emptied out my safe deposit box.
No, he wasn't.
As long as I have the original documents that show Yorick ceded the jumble to me, I can block whoever is trying to push in and change things.
Yes, you can, and I will help you do that.
I nodded. I wasn't in the mood for self-examination, so I didn't want to wonder why I trusted a vampire more than I trusted most humans. Since I didn't want to wonder about that, I looked at the screen door and wondered about something else.
Do the Sanguinati have trouble with mosquitoes?
You mean, do the big bloodsuckers get pestered by the little bloodsuckers?
Judging by my attorney's laughter, if I failed to turn the jumble into a viable business, I could always get a job as a stand-up comedian in a vampire bar.
Chapter 12. Aggie. Sunday, June 13th.
Aggie moved back and forth on the tree branch, studying the dead man lying within sight of Miss Vicky's house. The newest dead man? The last dead man? The dead detective man? How should the Crow Guard identify this one? There had been an abundance of dead humans in the jumble lately, but a decided lack of easily acquired meat, since they had died where alive humans had found them too quickly. If the newest dead man couldn't be meat, maybe he had something else that was desirable. There had to be bits of treasure in the man's pockets, but she didn't want to get Miss Vicky into trouble by poking around, and the rest of the Crow Guard who were watching the body, and the police, reluctantly agreed.
This body has been disturbed.
How had the human called Officer Grimshaw known that about the first dead man? He hadn't been there when the smaller Terra Indigene found the body and removed the useful items like the knapsack and thermos and the shiny that had rectangles of paper and other things. Well, the eyeballs were gone, so that might have been a clue. Police were always looking for clues in the TV shows Miss Vicky liked to watch. But had he known about the other things? Ilya Sanguinati had known, or at least suspected, and had demanded that all the possessions be brought to Silence Lodge, as his condition for helping Miss Vicky. And they had brought everything to the lodge, except the eyeballs. Officer Grimshaw had taken the one she would have had for lunch yesterday, and Aggie suspected that one of the Weasel Guard had made off with the other eyeball before the crows had gathered to check out the first dead man. And the weasels didn't even like eating eyeballs, so that was just them flipping their tails at the crows. On the other wing, Ilya Sanguinati had said he wanted to see what the first dead man had brought with him in order to figure out why the man had been trespassing at the jumble. He hadn't said he would keep the useful things. Still, she'd given up the shiny case that held the rectangles of paper in order to help Miss Vicky, and now there was this dead detective man who was bound to have some treasure. Except, Officer Grimshaw had already seen this body, so he would definitely know if it was disturbed by even tiny hands reaching into pockets to see what might be out of sight. He'd looked hard at the body, had even touched the neck like they did on TV in order to know if a human was dead, like they couldn't just tell by looking or smelling. Dead did not smell the same as alive. Even young crows knew that. But apparently, humans didn't, and needed to touch. Then she noticed a piece of cloth poking out from beneath the body. Humans called it a tie. One of her kin had seen a shiny clip to the cloth, had seen it glint in a beam of sunlight as the detective man had pulled out his weapon and challenged one of the elders, who was already angry about the other two humans trying to enter Miss Vicky's house. Josie had flown off to look for food, leaving Aggie to study the dead man. She moved back and forth on the tree branch as she thought and thought about the shiny Josie had seen. She could get that shiny without disturbing the body too much. All she needed to do was pull the tie out from under the body just enough to reach the clip. Officer Grimshaw led young Osgood to the car. She couldn't see them, which meant they couldn't see her. She flew down to the dead man and looked again. Still couldn't see the car or the live humans. She grabbed the end of the tie and pulled, tugging it out from under the body inch by inch. When she couldn't pull any more out, she shifted her wings to tiny arms and hands that could squeeze between the ground and the body, following the tie until... there. She pulled out her prize, dropping it on the ground as she shifted arms and hands back to wings. Picking up the clip with her beak, she flew to the tree near the cabin she was renting from Miss Vicky, the tree that had a carefully built nest that hid a shallow hollow in the trunk. The hollow was just as carefully stuffed with sheets of paper that formed layers of hiding places for her little treasures. Aggie studied the layers of paper for several minutes before finding just the right spot for her new shiny. Chapter 13 Grimshaw. Sunday, June 13th. Grimshaw drove slowly toward the main road, listening to the tires crunch on gravel, listening for the odd and terrible silence that usually meant the presence of the elders. He stopped when Julian approached the car.
"Is there anyone here who could give Officer Osgood a ride to the police station?" Grimshaw asked.
He had left a crime scene unsecured, left a body unattended, when he knew there were predators in the area. But this wasn't a human town, or even a human place, and right now the need for caution, and the desire not to become the next dead body, overruled the basic protocol of investigation. Besides, he wanted to get the baby cop out of there before someone told Swin about the casualties to his team. Julian rested an arm on the cruiser's door, leaning in to speak quietly.
The firemen got the driver out of the car. The EMTs have him and are on their way to the hospital in Bristol. I'm fairly certain he'll be a DOA.
He waved to a man dressed in a white shirt and sports coat, holding a medical bag.
Talk to the doc about that ride.
Julian stepped back to give Grimshaw room to open the door and get out of the cruiser.
Doc?
Grimshaw said. The man looked too young to have his own practice, even in a small town. At least, that would have been true a year ago. Now, any doctor who was willing to practice in a small community like Sproing would be welcomed with open arms, and only a cursory check of his credentials.
Stephen Wallace, junior partner at the medical office in Sproing.
They shook hands. Then Grimshaw crooked a finger at Osgood, who reluctantly got out of the cruiser and said to Wallace,
"If you're headed back to the village, could you give Officer Osgood a checkup and make sure he's all right?"
"I'm fine,"
Osgood protested, still looking sickly pale.
"Then you'll be in and out and can wait for me at the police station. Man the phones until I get there. Will you do that?"
"Yes, sir."
Wallace pointed at a vehicle parked behind the hearse.
"That's my car over there."
Grimshaw waited until Osgood reached the car.
"Doc, are you the medical examiner?"
"More or less. I do determine the cause of death among the residents of Sproing, as well as among the families who run the farms and vineyards all around this area. But if there's a criminal investigation, or if it looks to be a suspicious death, the body is taken to Bristol for the autopsy."
That's what he figured, but he hoped for a little wiggle room.
"There's another body near the main house. Is there any place in the village where you could take a look at it and give me an idea of the cause of death?"
Wallace took his time answering.
"We can take the body to the funeral home, which also serves as our morgue, and examine it there."
His lips curved in a grim smile.
"Small town, small budget. The hearse is used to transport bodies. They already have the man who was killed in the car."
Grimshaw looked at the two men sitting in the front of the hearse, waiting for instructions. Then he heard a jangling and turned at the same time Julian said,
"We've got company."
Two men walked down the road from the direction of the main house. The dark-haired one was a big man wearing jeans and a muscle shirt, and had way too much body hair to wear a shirt like that. The other one wasn't as heavily muscled, and had golden brown hair and eyes, but Grimshaw had the impression of speed and power that would easily match the other man's brawn.
Where had they come from?
Grimshaw wondered, taking a step toward them.
"Something I can do for you, gentlemen?"
They ignored him and looked at the trees on either side of the road. Finding two that suited them, the leaner man padlocked two coils of chain around the trees. Then they uncoiled the chain the big man had carried over one shoulder. Simple hooks on each end were slipped through links in the padlock chains. Attached to the middle of the long chain now blocking the access road was a wooden board with the words, "Private Property, No Trespassing."
"Do you know this is Miss Devine's property?"
he asked. They stood on either side of the road, next to the trees.
"We're the groundkeepers and security,"
the muscled one said. Had Vicky Devine had groundskeepers and security before today? Or would she learn about her new employees when she returned from Silence Lodge?
"Your name, sir?"
Too many civilians and not enough weapons, even if he dared draw a weapon.
"Conan Beargard."
Oh, gods. That explained the build. And the hair. Grimshaw looked at the other male.
"Robert Panthera."
Grimshaw would bet a month's pay that the name was an alias.
"Do people call you Robert?"
"Call me Cougar."
A hand slapped the tree trunk, but in those seconds of movement, the hand changed. So what slapped the tree was a large, golden-furred paw with serious claws. That explained who had used a tree near the main house as a scratching post. Did it also explain Detective Chesnick's shredded legs? Or had something even bigger done that damage?
"There's a body up near the main house. We need to retrieve it. I promised Ilya Sanguinati it would be gone before Miss Devine returns home."
"We know,"
Cougar said,
You can take the meat.
You should tell that Swin human that he and his packmates aren't welcome here,
Conan Beargard growled.
I'll tell him.
Swin would go ballistic when that message was delivered.
We'll go up to the main house, do our police things, and remove the body. Then we'll be on our way.
Turning his back on the two Terra Indigene, he looked at Julian.
Consider yourself deputized.
No.
I've got one shot at collecting evidence and looking around. I need another pair of eyes, and someone with better investigative skills than I have. I left the force, remember? Get in the damn car, Julian.
He waved to the men in the hearse.
You follow me up to the house.
He looked at Wallace, who was still staring at Cougar's furry paw.
Doc, we'll meet you at the funeral home after you give Officer Osgood a checkup.
Wallace jerked. Then he regained his composure.
Of course.
He walked to his car. Cougar unhooked his side of the chain and walked across the road to stand beside Conan Beargard. Grimshaw drove slowly, not giving any of the predators watching him a reason to attack. He parked at the main house, opened the cruiser's trunk, then addressed the men in the hearse.
Give us a few minutes. I'll let you know when you can take the body.
Make it fast, okay, Chief?
The driver said.
I'm not the chief.
That's not what I heard.
He'd deal with that later. Relief breathed through him when he saw Julian taking the camera out of the trunk, along with the crime scene kit.
You know what you're doing?
Julian asked softly.
Doing what I can to supply my commanding officer with the evidence he may need.
Of course, the evidence pointed to Swin's men breaking into a house when they had been told they couldn't enter without a warrant. But that would be Captain Hargreaves's headache.
I mean about having me involved.
Swin will chew bricks if he discovers I collected any evidence. Another thing he'd deal with later.
Well, he'll never have a chance to look for himself, will he? Let's do this and get out of here.
The first thing he noticed when he approached the twisted body was the tie that was now partially visible, which meant someone had fiddled with the corpse in the past few minutes.
Gods above and below,
Julian breathed. He didn't say another word, just started taking pictures of the body in situ. Grimshaw looked around, moving out in an ever-widening circle. He found it unnerving that anything big enough to do that to a full-grown man also managed to leave no tracks, no sign of any kind of its presence. He bagged the service revolver that Baker had dropped.
Done,
Julian said. Grimshaw waved to the men in the hearse. The older man, who had been driving, paled when he saw the body and realized what face-down, feet-up meant. The younger one stumbled away and was sick.
We're going to take a look around back, Grimshaw said. Wait for us to escort you out.
Caw! 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 Caw!
The crow guard didn't follow them to the back of the house, but they weren't unsupervised, not with a big-ass hawk perched in one of the trees that gave it a clear view of the screened-in porch that ran across the back of the house. Blood in the grass. A lot of blood.
Whatever attacked must have hit an artery, Julian said as he took pictures.
Grimshaw noticed something glinting in the grass. He pointed.
Take some shots of those before I bag them.
Julian huffed as he photographed the set of lockpicks.
Damned fools, trying to break into this place.
Damned was right. Even the baby cop who wasn't physically hurt would be damaged by the experience. At the very least, he'd ride through a lot of nightmare-filled nights. After bagging the lockpicks, Grimshaw turned the handle on the screen door.
Brain!
Julian breathed out the word. The door opened, proving Chesnick had gotten the door unlatched before he was attacked, proving he had broken the rules of staying out of Miss Devine's house.
Someone used lockpicks to open this door, he said in a loud voice. From what I can see from here, the intruder didn't actually enter Miss Devine's house or disturb any of her possessions,
but we will inform her attorney about the attempted break-in. He started to shut the door.
Wayne!
Out of the corner of his eye, Grimshaw saw Julian drop to the ground. He hunched his shoulders and lowered his head a moment before he felt the tip of a wing brush across his back. An aborted attack or a warning? Shaken and not daring to reach for the door again to shut it, he and Julian gathered the evidence and their equipment and headed for the front of the house. Grimshaw glanced back. The hawk they had seen was still in the tree, watching them. The attack, or warning, had come from a different direction. Something to remember, since he was certain he'd be coming back to the jumble before this was over. Chapter 14. Vicky. Sunday, June 13th. After receiving a call from Officer Grimshaw, Ilya Sanguinati gave me a ride to the pizza shack so that I could pick up dinner. He wouldn't explain why he had ordered a large meat-eater's pizza with double meat, as well as the mushroom and black olives pizza I had ordered for myself. Well, I'd be sharing it with Aggie if she decided to join me for Cop and Crime Night on TV. Then I met my new employee lodgers, Conan Beauregard and Robert, call me Cougar, Panthera. And I understood why I was bringing home what you could call the carnivore special pizza, which had so much meat you couldn't tell there was sauce, cheese, or a crust underneath. I looked at Conan and Cougar and hoped it was meaty enough that they wouldn't be looking to nibble anything else. I rather liked having 10 toes, not to mention a full set of fingers. Aggie arrived before I could set out plates at the round kitchen table that seated 4, but could squeeze in 5 or 6. She was a little wary of the boys, but that wore off in a hurry. My wariness didn't wear off as fast, but I think I was entitled to a few moments of anxiety. After all, I, the dumpy human, was sitting with a bear, a cougar, and a vampire, because Ilya Sanguinati stayed and had a piece of pizza with the rest of us. I wasn't sure if he liked it or just didn't want to make it obvious that he had other dining preferences. Or maybe he understood that having a known predator sitting at the table would help me get acquainted with the boys who were chowing down on the carnivore special. While we bonded over pizza, I learned that Conan had settled into one of the jumble's cabins near Mill Creek, because the creek provided good fishing, and he liked eating fish. Except for making patchwork repairs on the roofs and replacing a couple of broken windows in order to prevent any further weather damage to those cabins, I hadn't done any renovating. By human standards, those cabins were still primitive, since anyone staying in them had to go to a separate building for toilets and showers. But Conan seemed to think the cabin was very human. Although the bed puzzled him, and he couldn't figure out how to sleep on it, so he'd been sleeping on the floor in his furry form. I explained that the mattresses had rotted and been removed, and that I would purchase a new box spring and mattress, as well as linens and blankets. Cougar was also in one of the primitive cabins, but he'd chosen one from the second set of cabins that were close to the lake. He, too, had been puzzled by the bed frame, but hadn't given it much thought. As we talked, I had the impression that Aggie had more of what they called a human-centric education than the boys, who made me think of young men in earlier times of human history who would give up formal education before finishing grade school in order to go to work. I didn't get the impression that Conan and Cougar wanted to get too humanized, but they wanted something enough to settle into 2 of the cabins and do some work in lieu of rent. I put away what was left of the vegetable pizza. After confirming what time Ilya would return in the morning to take me to the bank, I said goodnight to my attorney and settled in to watch cop and crime shows with my new friends. The boys had never seen television, so I had to explain that commercials weren't some weird schism in the story, that they were like their own little stories about something humans were selling and wanted other humans to buy. When Aggie said it was all right to talk during commercials, because no one wanted to listen to them anyway, That started a whole round of questions about why the TV police did or didn't do the same things the police who had been sniffing around the jumble had done, which made me wonder if I should warn Officer Grimshaw about how carefully he was watched when he came around to investigate. There were growls when the cops missed a clue, and snarls when the bad humans did something sneaky, and more than a few eye rolls over human behavior in general. At one point, Aggie shouted at a woman who approached a villain who was pretending to be hurt.
"It's a trick! There's no blood! Can't you smell that there's no blood?"
During commercials, I'd tried to explain about human senses without sounding too apologetic for the inadequacies of my species. I ended up feeling that all I'd managed to do was convince my new friends that fish were smarter than humans, even if humans did have those nifty opposable thumbs. The other thing I realized by the end of the evening was that humans and the others did have one thing in common. We both had a love for and fascination with stories. I learned that every form of Terra Indigene had its own teaching stories, as well as stories that were the repository of their history and connection to the world. And they all had stories that were told for the fun of it. After the last show of the evening, the boys and Aggie went to their own cabins, and I triple-checked the porch door to make sure it was locked. Ilya had said one of the detectives had opened the door but hadn't gone inside. As I did my walk around the rest of the house, I stopped in the library and looked at the books I'd been buying from Let Us Read. I hadn't purchased anything I didn't want to read. With only one lodger, what was the point? Especially since Aggie seemed as enthusiastic about reading thrillers as I was. But now I looked at the books I had purchased and considered them with an eye to reading level. I was pretty sure Conan and Cougar would like the storylines and the thrillers. I was equally sure their reading skills weren't yet a match for those books, and making a trip to the story place had sounded like one of the big reasons those two had decided to interact with humans at all. If Ilya Sanguinati was willing to stick around the village for a bit before taking me home tomorrow, I needed to talk to Julian Farrow about some appropriate books before I talked to the boys about a trip into town. Chapter 15. Ilya. Sunday, June 13th. Ilya Sanguinati walked to the lowest level of the lodge's deck and stared out over the lake. Had he made a mistake allowing Victoria Divine to restore some of the buildings in the jumble? If the Terra Indigene had prevented any human from taking up the agreed-upon caretaker duties for one more human generation, the agreement the Sanguinati had made with Honoria Dane and her designated heirs all those years ago would have been considered null and void, and the buildings could have been claimed as part of the Terra Indigene settlement. Humans could have been denied all access to Lake Silence except the southern tip, which, per the agreement with the first humans who had wanted to settle near the lake, was accessible to humans only as long as Sproing remained a viable human village. But losing Sproing as a viable village would mean losing easy access to the Sanguinati's preferred prey. They had successfully hunted from the shadows since the village's founding, becoming more of a folktale that produced a delicious shiver than a real threat. Humans living and visiting Sproing believed themselves safe from those predators, even when the predators sat among their prey and became the seducers who were woven into a different kind of tale.
"This Victoria worries you."
Ilya waited until Natasha, his potential mate, stood beside him before answering.
"She is not what I expected."
Through the informants the Sanguinati maintained in the village, he had followed every step of Victoria's progress with the renovations so that he could reassure the Terra Indigene the rest of them feared that this human was behaving honorably. He'd also been careful to keep his distance, until the crow had come winging across the lake looking for help because humans had come to the jumble and had taken Miss Vicky away. Perhaps keeping his distance had been another mistake. The informants had been less forthcoming than usual. leaving him unprepared to deal with a human who was emotionally outside of his experience.
"You could have fed from her today," Natasha said. "The rest of us could see it, feel it. She reads stories about a vampire's kiss and would have given her blood willingly."
He nodded. No point denying what even Officer Grimshaw had recognized when the police officer had tried to stop Victoria from moving toward him.
"I could have fed from her, but only once. Then fledgling trust would have broken with whatever fantasy she has about our kind, and she would have run from any offer of help from us. No more flowing around the edges. With Victoria as caretaker, breaking the connection the Dane family had with the land, the jumble can become a functional Terra Indigene settlement again. But we need direct access to her in order to deal with this potential threat."
He hesitated, then added,
"Something inside of her is wounded. I didn't notice any damage. She doesn't move as if she were injured." "Not the body. This wound wasn't apparent, at least not to us. But the detective who was in the bank with her knew the wound was there and knew how to open it again. So she is vulnerable to attack."
"Yes, and like any other animal, she will hide the wound whenever possible to escape being targeted by a predator."
But hiding a wound wasn't the same as healing it. Was there anything they could do to help Victoria heal? Their plan to reseed Sproing with humans of the Sanguinati's choosing hinged on the jumble being restored and providing another source of transient prey. And the jumble's restoration hinged on the elders tolerating the designated caretaker. So far, they were showing more than tolerance toward Victoria, and the warning should be clear enough for even humans to understand.
"Perhaps we should watch some of those cop and crime dramas to find out how humans think attorneys should act,"
Natasha said, as they returned to the lodge.
"Perhaps."
He had never been inside a courtroom to defend someone or argue a case. He specialized in leases for land and buildings, and his client had always been the Terra Indigene. Until now. Victoria Devine hadn't been wounded during all these months when she'd been restoring the jumble, but she was wounded now. What was he supposed to do about that? His informants had failed to provide any information or give any warning. Perhaps that was as simple as loyalty to a friend, but that meant he wouldn't depend on them where Victoria was concerned. He needed another source of information.
"I'll join you soon," he told Natasha.
Then he went into the room that served as an office for all of them, picked up the phone, and dialed the number for a Sanguinati who had access to other resources.
"Vlad, it's Ilya. I need to understand wounds that affect the human mind and emotions. Could the Lakeside Courtyard's female pack help with that?"
Chapter 16. Grimshaw. Wednesday, June 14th. Grimshaw left the boarding house at first light and drove to a truck stop between Bristol and Crystalton. While he was on highway patrol, it was a regular stop for coffee or a meal. A place to sit and be quickly available without burning gasoline all day. When he pulled into the lot, he noticed the new addition behind the diner. There had been toilets, a convenience for truckers who pulled in to a designated, safe place after dark, especially after the diner closed for the night. Now there were also pay-by-the-minute showers, like the ones provided in a campground for those brave enough, or foolish enough, to stay that close to what watched them from the shadows of the woods. No sign advertising the new facilities, but the men and women who made a living on the road would know about the amenity. Captain Walter Hargreaves was already in a booth, a cup of black coffee in front of him. Grimshaw slid into the opposite seat, nodded to the waitress, who lifted the coffee pot and raised an eyebrow in question, then studied his boss.
"Swin and his CIU team work out of Putney on Prong Lake," Grimshaw said. When I called the Bristol station to confirm a suspicious death, why didn't the CIU team from Bristol come to Sproing to investigate?
That's a good question, Hargreaves replied. Then he smiled at the waitress and ordered breakfast. He waited until Grimshaw placed his order and the waitress was out of earshot before continuing.
All I know is that Swin called the Bristol station minutes after your call and said he and his team had been assigned to the case and Bristol was to stand down. He said he was already heading up to Sproing for a separate investigation and the suspicious death could be connected. So it made sense for him to take a look at the alleged body. He swallowed some coffee, his eyes never leaving Grimshaw's face. His call came in so fast after yours, I started thinking he'd been tipped off, maybe even anticipated some trouble at the jumble.
I didn't call him, Grimshaw growled.
I didn't think he did, but he was expecting a call and already had his team ready to roll.
Including a baby cop who had no business doing more than directing traffic.
Hargreaves looked grim.
Tell me all of it. Tell me everything you didn't put in your report and wouldn't say over the telephone.
Grimshaw told him about the Sproingers' gathering and Julian Farrow's theory that they were a form the Terra Indigene had absorbed to be able to wander all around Sproing without humans thinking twice about their presence. He told Hargreaves about Vicky Devine's state of mind when she got out of the car after Swin and Reynolds brought her in for questioning, and the empty safe deposit box, and the sudden appearance of one of the Sanguinati, who claimed to be her attorney. He recounted the terrified call from Osgood, asking for backup, for help, and what he and Julian had found when they reached the jumble. Their breakfast arrived. Grimshaw shoveled food into his mouth for a couple of minutes, then put his fork down and sat back.
Osgood shouldn't have been there. He's too young to be on a CIU team.
Hargreaves kept eating for another minute. Then he too put his fork down, but he leaned forward.
Julian Farrow. You went into a bad situation with Julian Farrow as your backup? You're either crazy or suicidal.
I trust him.
Before Hargreaves could respond to that beyond swearing under his breath, Grimshaw asked the question that had been bothering him since he and Julian returned from the jumble yesterday.
All those years ago, did the brass know Julian wasn't into it? Did they know why he had that uncanny ability to sense things?
He saw genuine surprise on Hargreaves' face.
Into it? Are you sure?
Grimshaw smiled when the waitress came over to refill their cups and ask if they wanted anything else. The smile faded as soon as she walked away.
I'm sure. Julian confirmed it.
Hargreaves was thinking hard.
Crystalton. The reputation it has of being a woo-woo place, with people reading cards and talking about the properties of crystals and all that.
Bunk. Bunk? Or a smokescreen so that people coming into their community don't realize they're different.
Grimshaw countered.
What's he doing in Sproing?
He owns the bookstore, which, as far as I can tell, is really a combination of a bookstore and the village's lending library, since the front half of the store is more of a used book swap than anything else. I didn't see it, but I'm guessing the back half has the new books that he sells for some kind of profit, enough to keep the doors open.
Maybe, Hargreaves said softly.
Governor Hannigan created that investigative task force last year. Investigators who work with local police but answer to the governor.
I know of it.
Haven't met the ITF agent who has the Finger Lakes area. When he'd heard about the task force, he'd considered applying for it, but a man had to have some skill with working with a variety of police forces in the communities within his territory, as well as being able to work on his own. And the truth was, he really didn't work well with others. There were some rumors that there are a few shadow agents, as well as the ones who are visibly working with the police.
Undercover?
Hargreaves nodded and drank some coffee.
What do you think?
About what?
Grimshaw blinked. He almost laughed until he thought about it.
Julian Farrow?
He was a damn good investigator, even when he was a rookie. Of course, His being into it explained some of it, but he had a real feel for it. He opened his store... when?
Last fall.
Around the time we were all scrambling to figure out what was left after the humans' first and last movement set the war against the Terra Indigene in motion. Silence is the westernmost